We have all these metrics in place that evaluate whether it's good or bad design that have to do with addiction and don't have so much to do with making a really delightful experience.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview successful UX designers who fight for the user in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 11. So today I had the immense pleasure and privilege of speaking to Mr. No UI himself, Golden Krishna. What an amazing interview this was. Golden is a natural storyteller, which was perfect for the format of the show. I cannot wait to share this with you. So many great insights, especially touching on his new really amazing essential reading book, The Best Interface is No Interface. So I'm not going to talk anymore. I'm going to let you jump right into the interview. Golden Krishna is a deeply thoughtful design innovator. Even though his website introduces him with the humble title of UX designer, he's the visionary superhero creating a powerful ripple effect in the UX world through his pioneering of the No UI movement, starting with his popular essay that turned into his essential reading book, The Best Interface is No Interface. In his work at Samsung, he's been a part of the creation of products that the market has not even defined yet. He's also worked at Cooper solving big UX problems for Fortune 50 companies. I could probably spend the next 5 minutes going on about his accomplishments, but I don't want to cut any more into this golden opportunity to talk to the man himself. Welcome to User Defenders, Golden. I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
Thanks. Really flattered to be here on the program. Also honored that I was suggested by the legendary Josh Clark and some people on Twitter. I think a woman from Casey from Seattle requested me to be here. So
yes,
it's just really flattering and great to be here.
It's flattering for me to have you, I'm telling you. So, super excited. So let's jump right in. Every superhero has a secret identity. Let's talk about yours. I'd like to start the show out by you taking a few moments to give us a look into your personal life.
Yeah, sure. If you sort of look back at some of the things I've done, it's been a little bit crazy. It's almost a little bit more like, I would say, you know, my design superpower is something around time travel. You know, I've sort of pitched some crazy things. I think if you know, just like looking back at my career and kind of thinking a little bit about this podcast, and even what's been going on, I thought about this one time in 2011 when I had this idea for a client. They had this incredibly complex service. I had gone out and talked to their customers, observed the way they use their service, and my solution was to take the entire thing and try to reduce it down to what I thought then was the most simple and elegant solution, which was just text messaging. And I thought there was so much temporary novelty in just sort of touching and tapping, and I thought, hey, let's eliminate the app entirely and run the whole thing in the simplest, best way possible. And I pitched this idea to the client, and they thought I was crazy. We didn't go forward with the idea, but today, 4 years later, messaging apps are a hot trend, and every time I see an article sort of talking about them or a tweet, I just sort of kick myself in for not being able to convince the client of sort of what I saw coming. And when I think about this User Defenders podcast and what could sort of be my superhero power, I guess it's time travel. And I think I'm definitely no real superhero. I'm far, far from it. But when I think about what it could be, I think it's about having this vision for a future. And I think it's about having a strong belief about where we should probably be going. And all of this is probably obvious in my book, The Best Interface is No Interface, which is about building a screenless world. And that sounds really crazy for a designer with a graphic design education to be saying, but I think that's where we should be going. And I'm excited to talk a little bit about that and also my sort of background here on the program.
Awesome. Well, tell us about your life. What do you like to do when you're not working on these just incredible ideas?
Yeah, you know, I obviously have a passion for design, so I'm always embedded in the tech world. But when I'm not doing the design stuff, I love stand up comedy, which might be reflected in some of the writing.
It is.
I like running, but I like running at night. There's something sort of great about just being in the peacefulness of the evening. I love baseball. I'm a big baseball fan. A lot of people don't know that about me. I love typography. It's actually another sort of, it's funny to rant about this sort of screenless world because I'm a huge fan of type. But I think there's something really something awesome about communicating to people in the most clear way possible. And so, that's where some of my love for typography comes in. Yeah.
But I appreciate typography as well. I think, you know, in this content rich world we live in, it's really important to have a clear, clean, aesthetic, especially with typography, because that's most of what your experience is based around.
Yeah, absolutely.
Golden, tell us your starting out story. What inspired you to pursue UX design as a career?
Good question. You know, so I mentioned that I studied graphic design, and you know, at the time that I was graduating, and this is sort of, I think this is a continuing trend, you're just seeing more and more interest in the world around technology. And so I kind of turned away from a lot of the things that a lot of my sort of peers and teachers were pushing me towards, which was more the advertising and you know, print world. And I dove into getting this internship at Cooper. And, you know, that time in which I started working at Cooper was sort of a not so great moment in the economy, right? It's 2008 when I was applying, and Cooper didn't have an internship. I was applying to a lot of places. No one really wanted to bring interns on. But I had seen, and I really value a sort of academic approach to what we're doing in the design world. And I had seen a talk by Kim Goodwin, who wrote Designing for the Digital Age. And so I thought, you know, here's an organization that might get where we're going and where we're headed, and also a little more academic about the approach. And so I just emailed Alan Cooper directly. There was no application for an internship at Cooper at the time. And I just thought, you know, there's something so fascinating about what's going on here. There's so much opportunity. There is so much history in advertising, so much history in things like magazine design, and you can learn from generations to generations, but there's so much excitement, so much new going on in the digital world that I thought there's something there that I could really grab onto and help define this new, this sort of newer space. Anyway, so I emailed Alan directly, and he forwarded on to the person who was a director at the time there, named Nate, and he interviewed me. I came on, I did an internship, it went really well. I ended up working full time there, and it was amazing. And actually, after that internship, Cooper then started an internship program, which is great. That really was the beginning of my technology and design space. I mean, for a long, long time, I've been interested in. I mean, I could go back to thinking about when we had, you know, like Windows 3.1 in my house, and I used to mess around with the icons and try to make better icons than Microsoft designers had done. But of course, I never really could. But I used to try to mess around, try to do that. You know, I had a number of sort of websites that I ran in high school with the sort of 5 megabytes of space that our internet service provider at the time had given us.
Yep.
But, you know, I think my real career started when I was at Cooper, when I was learning so much about what we could do with technology there.
Yeah, and what a great takeaway to, when you see something you want, go for it. You know, you reached out to the man himself, and I commend you for that. and he saw interest and passed you to the right person. And I think that you're the reason they started that internship program. They're like, dang, we got this guy. Let's, you know, that's just a great inspiring story for all of us to, you know, when we're inspired to go for something, just to do it. Don't be held back by fear.
Yeah, I mean, I talk to a lot of students because a lot of students reach out after reading the book, and a lot of them ask about career advice. And being aggressive, kind of knowing what you really want, almost like two jobs ahead, because right when you get out of school or something, odds are you're not going to land that dream job, right?
Sure.
So if you know what you want to eventually be or become, you're probably not going to be able to get that job. And if you are able to get that job right away, you're not thinking big enough.
Right.
So if you have something in mind of where you want to go, it's nice to go after the things that will get you there. You know, get a number of years of experience doing the things that make you that perfect candidate for that dream job that you eventually want to get. Or just go for it aggressively and try to get that thing. But it's hard. It's hard out there, but, you know, it's important to just be persistent. And sometimes people aren't going to see your talent, and other times they are. And yeah, you never know what's going to take you in what direction.
That's great advice. And redesigning Windows 3.1 icons, there's only so much you can do with 16 colors. Golden, if you weren't doing this for a living, what would be your second career choice and why?
You know, that's a really good question. Before I jumped into the design world, I actually studied public policy, and I used to have these sort of dreams of, at that time, living in Cleveland or Detroit and kind of helping these cities that that needed help develop, you know, better lifestyles and better solve those problems for those cities. And that was from a public policy standpoint. And I was studying it, and, you know, I worked on a couple of sort of small elections. I grew up in Iowa, and worked on some small elections there. Eventually I worked on a presidential election. Campaigns are brutal. They're really hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard to sort of convince people as you try to do sort of the right thing in public policy. And I was really in that world, but I switched over to the design world because I always loved to do it, but I had never sort of brought passion and career together. I always thought of them as separate things. I thought, oh, that's what I do for fun, is all this sort of art stuff and design stuff. What I do for a living is something more serious. And so I guess you could say, if the design world didn't exist and there was no sort of movement going on right now, and we were, you know, maybe 200 years back in time, I might be doing some things, continued down that path of public policy and sort of trying to help at a more macro level than I am today.
Awesome. And the public policy background, that makes a lot of sense now that I think about it. For you getting all this experience in that arena, which is very challenging, like you said, and then to be pioneering this movement that is really causing a lot of conversation, a lot of really important conversations to happen. So I think that's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so much of the book and so much of what I'm inspired by is just sort of looking around and seeing what's going on in the world. I mean, it's not anything new to say that we're sort of drowning in screens. I mean, but you start looking at some of the stats and they're really crazy, right? I mean, kids look at a screen, children under the age of eight, I think in the U.S., look at a screen for about 2 hours a day. Teenagers who are mostly in school look at screens for about 7.5 hours a day.
Wow.
And adults in the United States look at screens for about 8.5 hours a day. And that's crazy. Those numbers are really high. And we all kind of try to poke fun of teenagers who are sort of addicted to Instagram and whatnot. But as sort of the makers of this technology, this is sort of our output, right? I mean, when I was doing more public policy stuff and that reference, I would look at people and I would say, oh, you know, you're working at this big, you know, like coal power plant. How could you not realize the effects of your industry and what you're doing to the environment and so on and so forth? But I think as technologists, we have this sort of, as designers, creators, and makers of technology, we have this sort of look on the world where we think, oh, we're solving people's problems, we're trying to make it better. But one of our outputs is this cultural effect, right? Where we are trying to get people addicted to their experiences, and we think, oh, they're tapping, they're engaging in our app more often, they're engaging in our web, they're clicking on icons more often, that's a good thing. But when we're trying to manipulate people to do that, we're having this effect, this large effect on the world, and we're not actually solving things in the most elegant way possible. And that's where some of this controversy falls into place, I think, that you're referring to, is that we have all these like metrics in place that evaluate whether it's good or bad design, that have to do with addiction and don't have so much to do with making a really delightful experience.
Hmm. Absolutely agree. I have kids, and this may be, people may not like me saying this, but I don't want my 10-year-old daughter to have a phone with sharing pictures on Instagram with the world. I feel like it's become sort of commonplace now. That's my personal opinion. But I also feel like, in this world of technology and screens and texting, we're losing the art of conversation. We're losing the art of appreciation, I think, for creation, for the things that we can see and behold and experience apart from our screens. And I'm talking to myself too, because I am a screen addict. I'm not going to lie. It's such a routine, I wake up, it's next to me. I go to bed, it's next to me, And so I appreciate that thought.
I mean, you know what? If you're someone who is really trying to keep up with the news, trying to communicate with lots of people, you kind of are, right? And there's good things that screens can do, but there's so much of what we make in technology that tries to get people using it more, right? Like, if I made a spoon to eat a bowl of soup, that spoon made eating a bowl of soup take about 3 hours, right? Because the spoon was so small and the soup always fell out of the spoon. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't be a good design solution for eating a bowl of soup. Yeah. But if I said, I have this other problem, I want to sort of connect friends, and it's a very human, very great goal, but it took 3 hours to connect with friends, and it was a sort of addictive experience where it took way longer than I wanted to take, and all that I really got out of it was some filtered images of their life. I wouldn't say that's a good solution either, right? I mean,
sure.
We're here to help solve these problems in a quick way and also in a delightful way. Mm. So there are good things that screens do. We just need to, and we can greatly reduce the amount of screen time that's necessary in people's lives.
Mm. Yes, I totally agree. Golden, who has been the biggest inspiration in your work and why?
I mentioned working at Cooper and... Yes. I had already, so when I went to school, art school, I graduated from CalArts, which is a great art school in Southern California. And there I had a lot of rebellious sort of teachers, people had sort of pushed the envelope, and that was really nice. And then when I started working in this sort of tech world, I was surrounded by Alan's sort of crazy thoughts and his ability to sort of just say the truth without worrying too much, or really, as I'd say, at the point in which I met him, much at all about the reactions of the room. I mean, there's this great story that someone told me who was then working at the Tech Museum in San Jose, and Alan had come in to do a presentation to some of the donors, major donors in the room. And Alan was starting up his PowerPoint presentation, and it wouldn't start. So he asked if anybody in the room was from Microsoft, if they should. And is anyone here from Microsoft? Can you please stand up? And a number of people from Microsoft stood up, and what they thought was he was going to ask for help. And what Alan instead said was, "You should all be ashamed of yourselves." And it was just fun, sort of like poking fun of, hey, look, I can't even get my presentation started. And Alan just didn't have this fear to sort of just say, to tell truth to power, to say, look, this shouldn't be that hard, right? I have this sort of formatting issue. This doesn't make any sense, right? Why is it that something so simple is so difficult to use? And Alan is great about being provocative in that sense, not just to be provocative, not for that very reason itself, but really to try to push the field forward. And so being around him a lot gave me additional confidence that it's okay to tell your clients, it's okay to be in a situation where you say something that's a little further out, that's a little that's best for the customers, even if it doesn't quite feel right for the company at this moment in time. And so even though I didn't have the years of experience or the sort of expertise he did, some of that confidence and some of that sort of ability and just, hey, go out there and just say it. It's okay if people disagree with you. It's about trying to do the right thing. That's really important, trying to do the right thing for your customers.
Absolutely. And the follow-up question, I think, for that Alan could have asked was, hey, any of you guys come up with Mr. Clippy? Cue the bouncer. All right, so sorry, a little levity there. Golden, what's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
You know, I actually think routine is a great habit. I'd say two things: routine and something that I discovered when I wrote the book, something that seems so stupid, which is turning off the internet. And routine works because you kind of fall into this pattern where I can say, okay, I'm going to do this thing and I'm going to just repeat it every day. So we're talking about the book. One example of that is when I was working on the book, I was also working at Zappos, and I would just go, so I live here in Berkeley, and I would travel to San Francisco for work, and I just show up in San Francisco about an hour and a half before my workday even started. And I'd go to Starbucks and I'd work on the book. I'd be that cliche person in the corner who's on his laptop. Oh, I'm just writing my book over here.
Nice.
And then after work, I'd do another sort of hour and a half. So I had this sort of, I think if you looked at it and you thought, okay, I'm going to do 3 hours a day about the book on top of work, that's a lot of hours. But I made it a sort of routine where I'd just get up a little bit earlier, I'd stay a little bit later, and I would just kind of do it all over and over and over again, all in sort of the same routine. And that was a really nice thing for me. And the more productive I got was a result of me being able to squeeze more things into the routine. So that's one really nice tool that helps me be more successful. And as far as productivity, another productivity sort of tip is really silly, but when I'm going through email, and I've been getting just so much email since the book came out, but it's been fantastic, is I just turn off my Wi-Fi, and I get so much more done when the internet isn't on. And that sounds so insane, but I just use offline email. I even write a number of tweets offline, and then I just get more stuff done because I think when I'm online, I just fall down this rabbit hole where I wonder one particular thing. And this happened a number of times when I was writing the book, where I would just think, okay, what was sort of the annual revenue for, I don't know, Pinterest last year? And I'd be like, oh, this will take me 5 minutes to look up. And I search for it online, and I start falling down this rabbit hole. And about 3 hours later, I'm looking at cats chasing lasers in the room. And then I look at my day, and I'm like, what happened to me? I was looking for Pinterest's annual revenue, and all of a sudden, and you just keep clicking on these clickbait things because you get hooked. I mean, you can't help it. People have sort of figured out human psychology, and they've written books about it, about how you can get people addicted to your experiences, and that's a scary but true thing, and so we all become victims of it, and so turning off the internet sometimes is a way to sort of like reduce the power of the services.
Now, is there an app for that? now, I love, there's so many takeaways, Defenders, from what Golden just said. And I think the main one is focus. If you really want something, you have to focus and you have to just go hard and achieve it. And it's crazy how the harder you work, the luckier you get. Golden, let's get into your transformation. Every superhero goes through a transformation when they realize the power that they have and they harness it for the greater good. Golden, you touched on this a little earlier, but what's your design superpower?
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned a little bit about being, and it's weird to sort of pick a superpower, but I think it's kind of really fun. I really do feel like it's this feeling of time travel, of wanting to be in a place that we're not and trying to get us there. And I'll tell you, I started to feel this the more and more I started to work with companies who wanted new stuff and wanted to know where they were going while I was at Cooper, and then it started to evolve. So after I was at Cooper, I worked at an R&D lab for Samsung where I got to do exercise this power more and more. Hmm. But the transformation for me started happening when really when I started working, I would say, with a couple of startups who were trying to disrupt certain spaces and thought, we need to be ahead of the curve. We need to be one whole generation ahead so that when the companies we're disrupting want to catch up, we're already a whole series ahead, or we're a whole calendar year ahead, potentially. And so I started having to think about, where are these guys going? What's happening in this particular industry? And I would say that's sort of when things started to change for me, when I started to think about what was happening and try to evaluate things better. I would also say another big factor while trying to come up with these ideas is really, honestly, user research. And it sounds like such an obvious sort of answer, but when I go into people's homes and you talk to them about the way they use their products, or you talk to them about particular services, you start to hear from everyday people the result of what we're making. And that really changes my perspective on it, because I think when you're a maker, everything that's new, you get excited about it. You want to get it, you want to download it, you want to try it out, you want to buy it. It doesn't almost even matter what some of these things do in our lives. We're just curious. I want to try it. But then when you talk to everyday people and you understand sort of the larger effects, I think that's when you see that good and bad. You see that sort of what it's doing. And you also see those incredible moments of opportunity. And so I've done a ton of user research in my career, and that's been another sort of huge, I would say, insightful and breaking point for me to be thinking in the way that I am today.
Using your skills to help improve others' lives and then hearing about it or seeing that through the research, that's great. Adversely, what's your design kryptonite?
You know, this is going to sound really kind of strange at first, but I keep this sort of like social score on coworkers sometimes, and it sounds a little bananas, but there's this kind of person that is really sometimes hard to be around. So let's talk about the opposite. Let's say there's someone who's just great in the workplace, right? Let's say everyone has frustrating days, right, at work. And let's just say there's some person, I'm just going to give this person a name. Let's just say his name is Glenn, and I'm really frustrated. I'm having a terrible day at work. But because Glenn is in the company, I decide, hey, I want to stay here. I want to make this work. And so I would kind of score Glenn in that way as a plus one. He kept one person at the company, right? He's kind of a plus one recruiter. Mm-hmm. And if Glenn had that effect on a large team, you might give him like a plus three or a plus four. But I have sadly been around, and I'd say these people are my kryptonite, people who are the opposite, right? Who are so frustrating to be around, who are so closed-minded, who are so in the mindset of the way it's done now is the way it should be done forever. And right, especially for someone trying to push the envelope is so hard. People like that become roadblocks, right? I have sadly worked with someone in the past who I would score as a negative four, being that four people left because they had to work with this other person. And we don't really have a ton of tolerance in that in the tech world today, because there's such incredible demand and there's such great job placement rate at this moment in time, that when you have people like this, they kind of destroy the experience for everyone. I would actually, yeah. I mean, we don't really, one of the really interesting things as I sort of digest this is that we don't really value people's salaries. We don't really quantify someone in that way. Like we'll pay somebody based on number of years of experience or based on job title, but we often don't. I would argue, you know, in this case of a person, this person, imaginary person, Glenn, that I'm describing. And by the way, I did work with someone named Glenn once who was a great person. So if he ever hears this, Glenn, you did a great job. But I'm just being more abstract here. And I would argue that this person who's got like a plus four score actually should be earning more money because in a way they're sort of recruiting within the company. Hmm. But my kryptonite, the thing that really gets in the way for me are these sort of people that are roadblocks and make the team feel sort of worse about themselves while doing the work. That's not a great thing, and there's definitely a bit of that out there, and so it's nice to avoid those, working with those people if possible.
Absolutely agree. And I was going to ask you, this isn't one of my questions I was going to ask you, but I just thought of this. How does one get to be a plus four, like on your scale? Like what are the qualities? And this is for me, this is for our listeners. You know, how does one in on their teams get to be that plus four?
Yeah. You know, so I want to say being nice to people is really, really important. Mm. It's also really important to be pushing your coworkers. I actually think someone hits that kind of score when they respect you, but they also know how to push you forward. So I don't think you reach a plus four if you're somebody who's just polite. I think that's an important quality to be respectful to the other people. But I also think, and this is where things get hard because you have to do this in the right way, but pushing people forward, right? So if I'm around a group of people where I feel like I'm not learning anything, but I really like them, I might not want to stay there because I want to learn more. And maybe that's not universally true, but I think for a lot of people who want to be good at what they're doing in their career, they want to be learning from somebody. And I think this could be said about the design world, but this could be said about a lot of other professions too. You want to be sort of pushed around by the people who are around you, right? You want to be, you want to get smarter by going to work. Yeah. And so it's this balance, I think, of a couple things. I mentioned respecting other people's work, understanding where they're at, where they're coming from, and where they can go. And then it's also this ability to sort of push them forward, understand sort of their strengths and say, hey, you're really good at this particular thing. You're great at it. I'm going to encourage you to do it. And together we're going to work in this sort of seamless way. I would say another big factor of it is just having that sort of great energy, right? And sort of being that positive person. You don't have to be screaming up and down and shouting or laughing really loudly or anything like that. But just having the energy when they walk into the office, when you see them, you think, oh yeah, this is great. I'm happy to see that person. I think those are the kinds of qualities that can lead to that sort of like plus four. But, you know, different groups value different things. Those are things that I value. And I think of them as more generic and universal. But, you know, in a different region of the country or in a different country entirely, they might value some different sorts of traits.
Thanks for answering that. There's a lot of good insight and takeaways from that. Golden, this is a kind of a fun question. And just to preface this question, we know that even superheroes need help. Even superheroes have people that help them in their quest. Now, what would you say your UX design superhero name would be?
You know, what's funny is having a name like Golden Krishna.
That's superhero kind of.
It leads to all sorts of, you know, ordinary nicknames, actually. You know, so my nickname in art school was Michael. And actually, if you were to go to a coffee shop or a restaurant with me today, I usually give the name Michael, even though Golden is so is so unique. People usually write down Gordon or something else. But I do think I once got this incredible nickname. I had given a talk about this, you know, this best interfaces, no interface, South by Southwest, and
yes,
there was some coverage of it in The Verge, and one of the first comments. Actually, some of the first comments were about my name, and people didn't think it was real. They thought it was sort of
a stage name.
It was my given birth name, but it was sort of like, so people were coming up with all sorts of alternate names.
They were trying to help you.
they were trying to help me out, and so they were saying, you know, golden is, you know, is like a, is like an element or metal, and then Krishna is like a, it's actually a Hindu god's name. So they were just coming up with other nicknames, and I think the first one someone wrote down there was Platinum Jesus, and so I showed up to work the next day, and we were in this, you know, sort of like team huddle in the morning, and someone calls me Platinum Jesus, and then that sort of picks up, and this is when I was at Samsung, they kept saying it over and over. Before you knew it, I was signing my emails PJ, and I thought that was kind of great. So so PJ or Platinum Jesus is sort of a bizarre, weird, totally kind of amazing that someone's internet comment became my real life nickname, but whoever that person is, they, I actually should find their screen name and try to find them. But that has become a funny nickname.
Oh, that's great. So, and Golden is good at sidestepping lightning bolts too. No, you know what? I love the Michael reference. I just immediately thought of Michael Knight, who was just awesome, right? In the 80s, you remember.
Oh, yeah.
You want to hear my Kit impression?
Sure.
Michael, I can't make that jump. Yeah, he was such a whiny car, wasn't he? Talk about screens, right, in cars?
He's Mr. Feeny, right? I mean, from, yeah, he's perfect.
Would you say that was the first screen in cars that we...
yeah. You know, there's something better about... He was LEDs, right?
Oh, yes, of course.
Wasn't that...
Those were awesome, that, even on the front.
Isn't that in some ways better? Yeah, even on the front. Isn't that in some ways better than what we have than what we have now with touch screens? I mean, I think there's something nice about all that information being so clear.
Absolutely.
Inside Kit.
Absolutely. You know, and design always repeats itself. I'm sure that we'll start seeing more of that as we get into this no UI world.
I hope so.
Yes. And then just a real quick compliment to you, Golden. Your South by Southwest talk, I could not believe that was your first talk ever. It was incredible. And I'm going to be sure to link to it in the show notes. You were just so just composed and confident, and you just hit on all the points. Just incredible.
Thanks. I appreciate that. There's so many actual sort of side stories and crazy things about what was happening at that moment in time that's sort of hard to see in the video. I mean, well, first of all, I wrote this blog post, right? The best interface is no interface. And I put a link at the bottom to vote for it to be a talk at South by Southwest. That's how I ended up giving that talk. But, you know, I'd written a number of blog posts that were crazy and a little bit out there, trying to push the field forward, that most people didn't care about. And I thought there was almost no chance that this would be clicked on enough times and voted upon, because once you click the link, you have to vote at the South by Southwest site, that I would even get into South by Southwest. But for whatever reason, at this moment in time, people were kind of ready for this idea, and the essay got spread a lot, and so many people clicked on that link that I put in the largest room you can get put in at South by Southwest, which has, well, largest voted room you can get put in, which has 1,500 seats.
Wow.
And they gave me an hour time slot. And when they sent me that email, I thought that was a joke. I thought they had messed up. I thought my talk was supposed to be 20 minutes. I thought it was going to be, you know, 150 maybe. I thought that was an extra zero. And I got so nervous. But I had prepped just for months ahead of time. And so I was going to fly in Friday afternoon and give that talk Sunday around 11 a.m. And my flight was delayed. Then I had a stop in Denver on the way. And when I got to Denver, my pilot didn't show up. And then a snowstorm happened. And then I got in I could tell you a 2-hour story about how I got delayed by over 30 hours.
Oh my gosh.
And I got there Sunday morning. I was supposed to get there Friday afternoon. I got there Sunday morning around 2 a.m. So I barely practiced my talk at all. I was so, because I was trying to figure out the travel situation. I got on stage. They'd given me an hour long time slot. I'd only had thought of about 40 minutes of content to say. I forgot 10 minutes of content on stage. My phone, which I was using to advance slides, died on stage because so many people were tweeting about the talk when it was happening.
There's
this moment in the video that's hard to see, but I pull my whole laptop over and I have to just click the arrow key. So all that sort of stuff was happening in the background, but you know what? It went really well. 30-minute talk, 30-minute Q&A. Hey, It didn't really matter to the audience. There were 1,600 people there because everyone sort of filled the room and up and down the aisles. It was an amazing experience, and it went really, really well. And it kind of it's sort of a career highlight for me for sure. So I appreciate you giving the shout out, but I'll throw in a little bit of crazy backstory in there as well.
I appreciate that. You know, that's the reality. That's the vulnerability, and I really appreciate that. Now I know our listeners are going to go and they're going to be like, wow, I want to see that talk, and I want to see. You know, see if I can see him pull his laptop. I would have never noticed that, honestly. It was awesome. So, and that was the start, I think, of, I know that was the start of really big things for you. So that's incredible. Golden, can you tell us a story about your biggest failure in your career? And I know this is a tough one, and it's something we don't like to talk about a lot, and it makes us vulnerable, but it does help us all grow, especially when we learn from others' mistakes. And failures really aren't truly failures, are they? They're stepping stones and catapulting us to our successes. So with that, would you tell us a story about that?
Yeah, of course. I think that's a great question. I mean, so often, you know, it's all about promoting, hey, this is this is how awesome I am, yada, yada. I think it's great to tell stories about times when we totally bombed. And those are, like you say, you know, those are moments where you learn a lot. When I went from Cooper to Samsung, right, I was in this R&D lab, and I could tell you a number of failure stories, but I think this is one of the more interesting ones. I was working on this massive project for them that I was leading, and I thought it could change. It actually would change a fundamental part of the experience for a number of their top selling products, and I had convinced my group that it was a good idea. I had done a fair amount of work on it with some people, and I had convinced some other groups at Samsung, because Samsung is this huge entity, right? So you have to convince a lot of people to make something happen. And finally, I got to the top of the ladder. I had presented this really big idea to this huge decision maker, and I got on this late night call here in San Francisco, along with a coworker who speaks Korean, and I was so proud of what I was presenting, because it was months and months of work, and so many people inside the company were excited about this idea. And for a variety of reasons, the decision maker said no to my idea. And it wasn't just my idea of something I was working with a group of people, but it was something that I was leading and I was trying to convince. And when that happened, I have this memory of walking back to my desk and just crawling underneath and wanting to just sleep forever. I mean, it was just months and months of work just flush down the toilet. And I, you know, when you're constantly trying to push boundaries, it's very common that you hear no.
Yeah.
But it felt like such a failure, because I've been trying so hard in my career to get people to the next step, and I thought this was one of the first opportunities I had to do that. But you know, you have to sort of pick up the pieces afterwards and figure out how can I continue to do this kind of thinking, right? I mean, these are the sort of moments where where I just, you know, I literally just lied underneath my desk, and I was like, I can't believe it. I mean, you just think about like months and months of effort just gone. Wow. The world will never see it. And but it's a lesson, because it shows, well, one, I felt good about getting to the point where I was able to talk to somebody of that caliber in the company and present that idea. But also, it was a lesson in, how do I do a better job of this in the future? Because I'm really interested in trying to push our field forward, trying to push the companies I work for forward. Mm-hmm. And I was put in this R&D lab to do it. And then, you know, I've been put in these other circumstances to do that kind of future thinking too, which has been great. But being able to get everybody on point and getting everything together, I think is so, it's a big part of, I think, what's missed when the average consumer looks at technology today. They think, oh, this is the best this company could do. Well, it's what the company could kind of convince itself to do at this moment in time. It's not always the best idea. And maybe it's what the company thinks consumers are ready for at this moment in time. I mean, I definitely pitched some ideas over a number of years that people have felt like was great and fantastic, but we're going to do that in 2 years. We're not going to do that today because our customers aren't ready for it. Totally fine. But if I think about the biggest failure of my career, I think of that moment in time because it was something that was just so much work and was so monumental that I just, and it was really just the feeling afterwards, just feeling like, oh my God, I can't believe I couldn't do that.
You know, Golden, I really appreciate you sharing that story. And I can hear in your voice that there's even a wound there still from just how much that hurt. And I can't imagine how much, you know, that hurt, you know, the feelings of, you know, having all your ideas sort of and all your hard work just not embraced. And but what I wanted to ask you is, what do you want our listeners to take away from that story?
Yeah, I mean, it's always, I think, worth the fight for your customers at the end. And when I say customers, I mean your sort of end users and trying to create those elegant solutions. Just because at one moment in time it didn't fly, at another moment in time the world could be ready for it or the company could be ready for it. And it's really hard. I've seen this happen so many times where someone comes in with a lot of energy and then gets kind of beat up and then just gives up forever. And maybe even in the worst cases, kind of feels like for the rest of their career, they shouldn't be pushing the envelope so much. They should just sort of punch in, punch out and get sort of the job done. That's really hard. It's really hard to try to do great work, but it's always worth it. And I will tell you, after that, I had some success on some things there, and it was absolutely worth it to keep fighting and keep trying. And fighting is maybe the wrong word, but it's more like making convincing arguments, putting sort of the things together that need to come together to show that this is a good direction, be really sort of high quality in your output. It takes a lot of work to do all this sort of due diligence to make it happen, but it's always worth it. And I think sort of the story is, it sucks. And I've been sort of like, I've been fighting for this stuff. I don't just talk about it. I do it in the workplace. And so I'm in the trenches, and sometimes you get hit by a bunch of bullets and you want to just say, all right, I'm just going to go home now.
Right.
But it's worth it to keep trying.
I love that. And you know, fighting is a great word, and it's really the theme of this, excuse me, it's really the theme of this podcast, you know, fighting for our users, you know, and our users are human beings. You know, we know that. However you call them, they're humans, and they're our end users, and that's really the theme, so I appreciate that. And of course, fighting for the businesses, too, and solving problems, so that's really great, man.
This is Jeff Barnaby with Brand Horse Creative. You are listening to User Defenders with Jason Ogle. Through education and inspiration, together we fight for the user.
Golden, do you have a story of something really crazy or super awkward that happened during user testing?
You know, as I mentioned, I've done a ton of user research, and I did a lot in my last job at Zappos, and I did a ton when I was working at Cooper. And I think, you know, when you do it, you try your best to filter for the right candidates. And so I've been able to chat with some amazing people, but every now and then you run into some crazy ones.
Right.
We once went to this customer's house for a client that I had a number of years ago, and he had this amazing house. He had this huge, just giant house, and we sat on these sort of beautiful leather couches. He got us glasses of water and this really nice glassware. So we're sitting in this sort of like this mansion, and we're talking to this customer. But then every so often, in the middle of sort of talking to us about something or showing us something, he would start screaming at his wife, who was in the other room. And he would, you know, hey, and it was really uncomfortable and just not just generally a great thing to do to another person. So, you know, maybe someone you don't want to create a great experience for, or maybe, you know, our product was creating so much stress in his life that, you know, you could argue that somehow we could make it better. But It was this experience of like, oh, we're in this palace, to this is the most uncomfortable experience of my life. And that transition is very memorable.
Oh, that is so good, man. That's probably the funniest story I've heard yet. I gotta say, at least two things. At least you were in his natural environment.
Yes.
And then, and number two, did you get any good data out of that test?
We did. Actually, we did. We got some really, it was really insightful. And the thing is, we'll never forget. I think it's been years, and I remember exactly what that guy told us. I didn't even need to take notes because there were so many amazing things happening at that moment in time.
Wow, that's so good. So good. So one of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, I fight for the users. How do you fight for your users, Golden? I know you touched on this a little bit.
You know, something I like to sort of talk about is how when you fight for users or even fight for these grander ideas, is that when you think about negotiation, right, it's always sort of good to hear no, right? Like if you wanted to earn $5 an hour and you ask for it and someone just says yes, the first thought you should have is, oh, crap, I should ask for more.
Right. Yeah.
And alternatively, if you had asked for, let's say, $8 an hour and they said, no, sorry, all we can afford is $6 an hour. Well, hearing that no is actually really nice because it might reveal their real limit. And I think in the workplace, when you're a user experience designer and you're sort of fighting for the users, you should be negotiating so hard that someone every now and then is saying no. You know, I think if no one is saying no to your requests, then you're probably not asking for a very aspirational experience. Actually, one of my personal goals is to walk into a meeting and have someone see me and say, this guy, not because I'm because I'm trying so hard to create an amazing experience for our customers. And it's that negotiation, I think that's a really, it's a different lens because we're so often trying to please, trying to please clients, we're trying to please our businesses. And that's important. I mean, I think it's important to hit customer goals and client goals and business goals. But I also think it's important to be negotiating and pushing the envelope. And that's, I think, where you're fighting for the users is when you're hearing no sometimes. Because if you're not, You're not being aspirational enough.
Oh, that's so good. Golden, this is the last question of this segment, but it's a big one. And you are definitely the right guy to ask this question of, what does the future of UX look like to you?
You're exactly right. This is sort of my bread and butter.
Especially as the time traveler.
Yes. And, you know, I think, you know, for the past few decades, designers have been, you know, trapped by screens. And I think it's actually gotten even worse in the past decade because entire companies that are looking for innovation or new experiences have been trapped by six trademarked words. Mm-hmm. There's an app for that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we've been trapped in this screen-based thinking. We've, as an industry, you know, are trying to solve everyone's problems by creating an app, by trying to solve them on a screen. We've been wondering things like, how can we solve early onset diabetes by using a form field? And, you know, good experience design goes far beyond screens, but we've been trapped into this thinking that it's our only output, our only sort of medium. I mean, on the front end, right? The thing we generally think of, we're looking at sort of the menus icons, the pointer, the tap areas. On that front end, we've been doing roughly the same output since 1978, where they first made those graphical user interfaces at Xerox. But on the back end, the processors, the stuff we don't really see, have gotten incredibly fast. The sensors and radios have gotten cheaper and embedded into all of our pockets. And now we have these incredibly fast internet connections almost everywhere we go. yet we're making the same experiences on the front end. And we're even doing it in ways today to get people addicted to those experiences, as I mentioned, where designers are evaluated by how many clicks they generate, how many page views, not by how quickly they can get done, not by building loyalty by making a product or service that people actually love. Hmm. And that's, of course, what I'm writing about in my book, The Best Interface is No Interface. But, you know, I think we have to sort of be cognizant of what we're creating and how we can sort of embrace technology and take it to a new direction. I think we're going to see UX shift away from thinking only in a screen. I think we're going to move in a direction, I hope we move in a direction where the screen is just one part of it, and it's considered a burden. It's considered a last resort, not necessarily the best possible solution. I mean, screens aren't going to go away. Digital interfaces aren't going to disappear in our lifetime. But I think we can do a lot where the future of UX and the way we practice is to create these experiences that reduce the amount of screen time, that try to solve a lot of problems using that incredible progress we've made in that back end.
Wow. So much to process in that answer. And thankfully it's recorded so I can do that later. But I have a quote here that from your book that you mentioned from Donald Norman, the great Don Norman. And it kind of speaks to what you just mentioned too. It's, you know, the real problem with the interface is that it is an interface. Interfaces get in the way. I don't want to focus my energies on an interface. I want to focus on the job. I don't want to think of myself as using a computer. I want to think of myself as doing my job.
Absolutely. I mean, Don Norman is great, actually. He wrote a blurb for the back of the book. I actually did this event with him, you know, where we talked about this essay. We kind of debated it back and forth. And he's been awesome about writing about and talking about this book now. But he's been talking about these kinds of ideas for a long time. I mean, I think, and the same thing is true even with Alan Cooper, who I mentioned earlier, and some other sort of great thinkers who... When graphical user interfaces were getting made, you know, Mark Weiser is famous for this when he talks about computing. When Xerox made the graphical user interface, they thought, okay, we made it. We did it. What's next? What's coming after that? And these guys were talking about, you know, late 80s, early 90s, and they were just, there's more theory. But today, when I'm sort of like trying to bring this conversation back, and we can do it. We can actually start to make some of this stuff happen. And I talk about a number of these kinds of experiences in the book, and a huge number of them are continuing to pop up. Actually, what's really funny is when I was researching for the book and trying to find examples, it was hard and it was a stretch, and I was reaching out to a lot of companies and I was trying to find those things. Today, I would say in the last like 6 months, there have been 4 or 5 startups who just started up all around this kind of thinking of how do we reduce screen time or how do we just solve people's problems elegantly in the background. I mean, there's some great products and services out there. Some are really, really straightforward. Some are really simple. I talk about one in the book called Lockatron, right, where it embraces this idea of making this sort of back pocket app, an app that delights you when you don't take your phone out of your pocket. So Lockatron's super simple, right? They have this door lock that goes over your deadbolt. Their 1.0 was ordinary, right? It was what we kind of getting away from, where you walk up to your door, you pull your phone out of your pocket, you wake it up, you hit the home button, exit your last open app, hit the home button, exit your last open group, swipe through a sea of icons, tap the app, and all you're wanting to do this whole time is just open your door.
Yeah.
And then their second cert, their 2.0, you just walk up to your door, Bluetooth talks to the door, to the deadbolt, the cover of the deadbolt unlocks your door when you're within a small range. You just walk in. It's this app that delights you. It sits in your pocket. Super simple example because it's just a door lock. But there's more complex examples that other people are sort of working on. I mean, there's this idea of back pocket apps, which I think Lockatron embraces, and there's some other sort of interesting opportunities out there. There's this startup called Ginger.io, which is looking at a number of healthcare solutions, and they've kind of run across this back pocket app idea where it tries to help people who have severe depression and looks for triggers in which their depression might be occurring and lets their healthcare provider know if it is. So they look at things like when you're waking up, are you calling friends and family, what kind of activity you're doing through the day. And they tried to do survey data. They actually did this interview with The Economist where they showed the results of asking people throughout the day versus this passive collection where you opt into the service and it just looks for those sorts of triggers, where their back pocket app, the app you don't even touch, is actually more accurate and can predict things about your mood more quickly. Mm. It's pretty amazing what they're doing. That, of course, is a far more complex solution for a very niche and small audience. There's something really fascinating about this idea of back pocket apps, but there's also a number of startups who are making technology in this past year who, and those two examples I gave are not from this year, but those are startups that have been, that are recent. And but the number of startups launching this year, there's one called Digit, which helps people save money. So a lot of people in the U.S., I think it's something, this should be maybe double checked, but I think it's a quarter of people in the United States who don't have 30 days of income saved in a savings account. Mm. And it's something that we do pretty poorly in the Western world of saving. So what Digit does is it plugs into your checking account. So you have to initially give it this permission. It looks at the way you're spending your money, and it slowly starts to move some of your money from your checking account to a savings account. And it starts off really gradually, maybe like $5 in the first month. But as it understands your spending patterns better and better, it starts moving and building a bigger and bigger savings account for you automatically in the background. And it's a really fantastic service that takes a lot of design effort to figure out how people spend their money, how people think about savings. It takes a lot of design effort to sort of pitch that larger customer journey, but doesn't take a lot of design effort from building screens, right? And so what's so amazing about Digit is it's not about setting goals and getting buzzes and beeps in your pocket as daily reminders to get you addicted. What's amazing about Digit is it just sort of works in the background magically and solves a problem that computers can solve really, really well, right? It embraces that back end.
Yeah.
Anyways, I could go on and on. I have dozens of examples, but I think there's a lot of fascinating things happening right now, and I think you're seeing it in startups, and I think you'll start to see it in bigger companies as they are able to embrace these ideas.
I'm really excited about it too, just seeing so many things already popping up, and I just can't wait for what the future holds for us as technologists and designers. So, Golden, let's wrap up the show with superpowers. What's your best advice for aspiring UX design superheroes?
You know, a few weeks ago, I got to guest critique a interaction design class at CCA. It's an art school here in San Francisco. And they asked me to give one sentence of advice before the class started. And I said to the class, your stuff isn't good enough, and it never will be. And I said that as sort of a punch, sort of a joke, but that as designers, I think we're always striving to make things better. Yeah. It's never going to be good enough. I think in the workplace, it's about prioritizing. These are the things I'm going to go after. I could try to tackle 100% of this and make every moment of this perfect, but it's never going to be perfect. Instead, I could try to tackle one or two things, go after those major moments in the experience, and try to tackle that stuff. As designers, we're always trying to make everything better, and we should be, and I think that's amazing. It's never good enough. If you look at something when it gets out the door, I think I'm usually often proud of personally, I got it done in this amount of time, and I got these things done. But whenever I look back at the work, I always think, I could have made that thing better. Could have made this thing better. But I'm proud about what I got done given the situation, right? And that you should take pride in your work so that you have confidence to move on to your next project and you're growing, you're developing. It's important. But you should always be trying to push yourself forward. And that's what I was trying to teach that class that moment in time is this isn't perfect. It's never really going to be. But as long as you're pushing it forward, that's what you should be doing.
Amen. Golden, as we close, why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and keep up with you?
Yeah, so I'm pretty good on Twitter, which is at Golden Krishna. I love email. I get tons of email. I'm just golden.krishna@gmail. I get so much that I'm sometimes months behind, I think, but I'm trying my hardest to keep up. I think the last 2 weeks I've sent 300 emails only related to the book. Wow. As I try to catch up, but my inbox is filled with it. I think it's great though. I think that dialogue pushes me, gets me to think a lot about more things. And those are two great ways to reach out to me for sure.
Excellent. Not to put pressure on you, but I just want to share that with your emails to me, you made me feel like I was the only person emailing you. So you're just a really personable guy and a really generous and kind person.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. Golden, thank you so much for being here today. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. I've learned so much, and I'm probably going to listen to this myself numerous times. and I know our listeners are going to absolutely love the content that you shared with us. So I just thank you so much, and I just want to say fight on, my friend.
Thank you, Jason, and thank you so much for having me here on this podcast.
I learned so much from Golden just from that time we spent. I definitely went over, and I apologize, Golden. Thank you for your grace in making the time, extending your time. So much great value, really fun conversation. Just a great guy altogether, and really smart idea guy for sure. And he's one of the guys leading us into the future. Highly, highly recommend checking out his book, purchasing it. The best interface is no interface. I will be sure to put a link in the show notes. I have been gobbling it up. I can't put it down. It's so good. If you're enjoying the show, I'd leap over tall buildings if you'd take a minute and leave a rating and review on iTunes. There's a link in the show notes that will teleport you right to it. Also, together we make a powerful force, so get on the weekly email list at userdefenders.com/join to find out who the next super guest is and get my usable thought of the week that's only published there. I want to thank Cesar Limas for the astonishing superhero artwork and Chris Combs for the superhuman editing. The compelling show music was created and produced by Wyman Gentry. Thanks again so much for listening, and until next week, fight on, my friends.